This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're spending the hour with Professor Marcus Kroom to learn more about his work and how it fits into conversations today surrounding education and things like critical race theory. Marcus Kroom is an assistant professor of literacy, culture, and language education at Indiana University Bloomington. He's also the author of Real Talk, How to Discuss Race, Racism, and Politics in 21st Century American Schools. Welcome to the program, Marcus.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here, and early congratulations on your upcoming anniversary as host of this show.
Well, thank you so much. Marcus, before we talk about the book you authored, I want to learn a bit more about your background and how you got started in the field you're in today.
Yeah, so I actually came to the field of literacy research as a music educator, and I mentioned a little bit about my background in the book. So while working as a music educator in Durham, North Carolina, I got involved as a teacher leader with a program designed to help African-American boys to advance themselves in literacy and also in other areas. And that work is what brought me into the field of literacy research with a concern and a focus on how race and racialization plays a role or may not play a role, for that matter, in the processes of teaching and learning. And so during my doctoral work at University of Illinois at Chicago, I did a study that helped me to understand that there are indeed some ways that race does play a role in teaching and learning, and also began to get a sense of what might be done in addition to a number of studies and scholarship already out there that very clearly has made that point over a number of years in the field of education broadly, and specifically in the field of literacy research. So, yeah, it was just my own work as a practicing teacher and as an educational leader. I was actually preparing to become a school administrator in my home state of North Carolina. But before I actually moved into school administration from the classroom, I ended up earning my PhD and took a different career path. But I bring all that to bear, education leadership, organizational theory, all that to bear in the work that I do as a scholar and also as a fellow educator.
Were you expecting to make sort of a little bit of a shift in your career? Was there some like pivotal moment that had you kind of focusing on other aspects that you might not have considered?
Well, I did expect, as I mentioned, to go from working as a teacher to working as an administrator. So that was absolutely expected. But in particular, to go in the direction of the field of literacy, that was not expected at all. That was as a result of working with my students in my school. And that work is what led me in the direction of thinking about the importance of making sure that African-American boys in particular, but really all Black students and all students broadly, get the kinds of instruction and the kinds of literacy experiences that they deserve. There's nothing wrong with Black boys. There's nothing wrong with Black girls. What they need is the kinds of instruction that we see very clearly documented in research. And when that happens, we see very good things and good results. When we don't do that, we see very clearly that we're not following what research has said over and over and over again with regard to human development and academic excellence and academic possibilities. So, yeah, so I didn't expect necessarily to come into this field, but once I got to know more about the field, read up on the literature, of course, spent time with other colleagues in the field, learning from my professors and so forth, I was able to see very clearly that my own sense of mission, my own sense of purpose could absolutely make a contribution. And that's what I've been trying to do ever since.
From my own outside perspective, the education field seems to lack a variety of voices in many settings, from teaching to academia. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that that's true historically. Absolutely. Again, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there that points to that there are some who historically have been heard or regarded more often than others. Some regarded as more legitimate. Even perhaps more professional or knowledgeable when there's not really a basis for that. Certainly that has to do with racial assumptions that sometimes people make. But yeah, historically, I do think that that's been the case. But I don't think that that's an inevitable or unchanging or unchanged reality. There is absolutely a shift in the field of education broadly, and in the field of literacy research specifically, with the number of voices that are heard, that are respected and regarded. Certainly doesn't mean that there isn't work that that needs to continue to be done. But it would be absolutely untrue to claim that things are now as they always have been in the past. That's absolutely wrong and far too pessimistic.
Oh, interesting. Far too pessimistic. So maybe I'm a pessimist then, because sometimes I feel like we hear a lot of conversations about change and growth and, you know, research, and then it just always feels like we're back to where we started.
Yeah. And that's a function of a few different things. So there is a way of thinking about this, that if we change the racial categorization of the people who are at the table, if you will, that in itself resolves it, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not addressing the fact that people have ideologies, people have histories, people have worldviews. It doesn't account for the multiple identities that are important to people that play out in all sorts of ways. So yes, in some ways, I certainly understand where you're coming from with the sense that some things are never changing, but that's not merely about phenotypic or racial classification per se. Now we're getting down to the deeper issue of worldviews, of ideologies, of power, distinctions or differentiations or the unfair use of power. So, in that regard, if we don't, regardless of your racial classification, regardless of what your title may be in the field, if we don't get down to the fundamental worldviews and ideological kinds of things and the power kinds of things that are at play in all of this, then yeah, it's very easy for nothing to change while the faces may change or while who gets, you know, what role or what office that may change. But yeah, it's absolutely, you know, a reasonable feeling to say that it doesn't feel very different sometimes. And that's because people need to change before institutions and structures can change.
That's really interesting. I never thought of it from that perspective. With regards to the stuff that you do in the field of literacy, culture, and language education, what does that entail?
Yeah, so in my work, I focus very specifically on how racialization is conceptualized and how it's evidenced in what happens in instruction, for example, but in any number of ways beyond classrooms as well. So the book gets into how race is important and how race is practiced in the broader society and in relationship to schooling and, of course, to human beings. That's an image that I put in a book to illustrate what I refer to as the reality imperative and how those three, human beings, society, and schooling, are all interconnected and inter-influencing one another. So with regard to racialization, I'm thinking about and trying to understand better, well, what does race have to do with it, right? How does race play a role, or how does race figure into what it is that we're looking at? And so in order to really understand that, however, we can't approach it from what I refer to as the common sense view of race. And the common sense view of race is exactly what it sounds like. There's nothing unusual. There's nothing new or special there. It is the way of thinking about race that most of us have been raised to think, that most of us are thinking, you know, even at the moment of this conversation. So the first thing, and this kind of begins to get back to the worldview point, that we have to do is to rethink whatever we think we know or whatever we think we understand about race and racialization. And when we make that step and start questioning what we took to be the case with regard to race and racialization, it opens up possibilities for us to understand and see some things that we might not have understood or saw before. So that comes in terms of understanding race as practice. So race is not a bodily trait. Race is not in your DNA, your cells. It's not in your epidermis. All those things are well, you know, documented and well argued in anthropology and other fields, et cetera, DNA, et cetera. But that's not necessarily kept pace, or I should say it this way, our public views have not kept pace with that research and with that evidence, something that even Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois argued long before it became important and kind of widely accepted later on in research and in science. So my point is, we have to depart from whatever we think we know and whatever we think we understand about race, be willing to question it, be willing to rethink it, and open up ourselves to an alternative account of race that is far more sound, far more systematic, and far more reliable. And practice of race theory is what I've been articulating and publishing about to help us as researchers, as well as practitioners, understand race much more clearly and be able to take that theorization of race into how we collect and analyze data, make claims, understand the world, account for real things that are happening in the real world, also things in classrooms, as I did in a multiple case study for my dissertation, et cetera. So, yeah, so that's what I've been doing and will continue to do, is just to try to understand what race has to do with how we're thinking and how we're practicing in education specifically, but also more broadly in the world.
We have about 2 minutes before we get to break here. And I know this is not going to be like a quick answer to get to the solutions. I'm sure it's so nuanced and there's so many things, but you mentioned taking a step back, reevaluating what you know and things like that. Is that the most difficult step to take in this process?
Yeah, it can be. It doesn't have to be, but it can be, because again, and in this respect, it's a lot like schooling. We think, to make a quick parallel, we think we know what school is all about. And why is that? Because all of us, for the most part in the United States, went to school. So we think we know what school is all about, even if we haven't looked at school critically. We haven't looked at school with a particular kind of a specialized, questioning, expert kind of a lens. We tend to think of school as something that we all know and understand, and therefore, you know, we don't really need to take it any further than that. That is absolutely true with understanding race and racialization. We all think we understand what race is all about. There's a lot that goes unsaid, and yet we learn it, even though it's not necessarily explicitly taught to us, like sit down on the couch or sit down in the classroom and teach you this about race. It doesn't happen that way. It happens through our day-to-day experiences, our life experiences, et cetera. And so because of that ordinary process of human socialization, acculturation, et cetera, socialization, those are the kinds of things that we tend to stop at unless we've, you know, taken the time to ask ourselves or allowed ourselves to be a part of a process that requires us to question and rethink whatever we already assume that we know because of whatever experience we're coming to it from.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Marcus Kroom. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past All-In episode, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All-In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing all things education with Marcus Kroom, Assistant Professor of Literacy, Culture, and Language Education at Indiana University Bloomington. He's also the author of Real Talk, How to Discuss Race, Racism, and Politics in 21st Century American Schools. Before the break, we were discussing your personal experiences in education and getting into this field. And I do want to ask you, you mentioned your dissertation. You did a case study. I'm intrigued to learn more about that.
Yeah. In short form, I had a multiple case study that involved two racially white female teachers and two students. Those two students, one was a racially black girl and one was a racially black boy. And through that process of surveying, interviewing and observing what happened during those teaching interactions among the teachers and students involved, I really wanted to understand, well, how are these teachers conceptualizing race? What does race mean to these teachers? And certainly, in addition to that, well, what's important about that? What's significant about how they're understanding race and how that's being evidenced in things that they're doing, things that they are saying, practices with regard to how they're teaching, et cetera. And so after thinking about all the different ways that I could find at the time to try to understand what I was looking at and the data that I collected, I came away with some practices that I could find patterns around, because I was trying to find, well, what are the patterns here? What are the patterns that seem to be pointing in this direction or that across all the evidence that I had? And so those practices are what I talk about and what I find, what I in my findings, I should say, and what I think that contributes to the field. And I didn't bring my dissertation. I'm just kind of talking off the top of my head, but it is something that I can kind of go further into either in the show notes or point you to published research that draws on that, because I'm still publishing from that original body of data and also preparing for other studies as well.
Yeah, definitely. I'll put a link up for folks who want to learn more. How did these experiences ultimately lead you to writing the book that you have, or was this something you'd always planned to write?
No, the book was not at all something I had planned to write. So the book is a very specific response to events, specifically, as I mentioned in the book, January 6th factored into that decision, direct communication from organizations and educators in the state of Indiana around how do we respond to this context, this situation that we're seeing on the horizon of either legislation or just public reaction or things that they were seeing in their own local school communities, things of that nature. So the book is a response to things that really availed themselves to me and really showed up, so to speak. And so it started with a presentation that I offered for the Indiana Black Expo and the School of Education at Indiana University. It was a conference sponsored by both of those organizations. And so I was invited to be a speaker, one of the speakers for that event. And so not only did I prepare and certainly present at that event, I also began to prepare and then ultimately publish the book, as you've been referring to, Real Talk. And so it wasn't at all something that I had planned to think about or to do years ago. It really was, how do I take all that I've learned and all that I might be able to bring to bear to try to help and support educators who are trying to make sense of this terrain, who are doing the best job that they can do to be professional educators, to be helpful to their students and to their communities. And they're facing some really, really challenging and conflicting and fast moving kinds of issues on the ground day to day. And so, you know, as a veteran educator myself, I'm sensitive to that. I know what it's like to deal with the day to day of having to respond and do the work of teaching and learning in classrooms and real schools from kindergarten to grade 12. I worked as a music educator from kindergarten all the way up to grade 12. So I get it in terms of being very sensitive and sympathetic to educators who are doing the job every day. And so if I could offer something that's research-based, something that's sound, reliable, critically insightful, et cetera, I wanted to do that.
And so the book also, you have the Real Talk method, in addition, finding ways to discuss race, racism, and politics. How did you come up with this way to discuss it? You mentioned your research and just some of the own experiences that you've had.
Yeah, I mean, it really was one, reflecting on my own practice, two, reflecting on broader research that talks about ways to communicate, to go through new information in ways that are helpful and not confusing. But also, again, this is kind of bringing school administration and teaching, you know, to bear, remembering, you know, the context and the reality of what it's like to work in schools and to be on the ground day to day trying to do a good job in a school. And so all of that is what informed and what brought me to the Real Talk protocol, which is five steps that I outline in the book that I suggest for educators to think through, to walk through as a way of helping them to be prepared to interrogate themselves first and foremost, but then also to interrogate whatever particular issue that they've decided they'd like to talk about based on either students saying these are things that we want to talk about. It's showing up in your classroom. It's not something that you started or you created. This is what's happening. And these are the kind of things that students want to talk about. Well, how do I respond to that? Right. Or it could also be from the side of, as professional educators, as more knowledgeable others, more knowledgeable adults who are trying to do the best we can to prepare children for the real world. I think this is an important conversation that we want to walk them through and make sure that they get good information and understanding, not misinformation or misunderstanding. So all of that is what brought me to the Real Talk Protocol. It was not something at all that I tested out in a study first and kind of built into this five-step process. That's already something that I have in mind in terms of carrying out research with educators on the ground and finding out from them how well does it work. So this is not at all research-based in the sense that I've done the research with this model and therefore I can prove X, Y, and Z if you do these five. No, that's not it at all. Through trying to offer, and this happens all the time in education research, there are absolutely some things we have evidence for. There's a lot of other things we don't have evidence for any number of reasons, not because we don't try or because we're not interested in getting that data, but sometimes it's just simply not something we have evidence for. And so this is an example of what we would think of as best practice, drawing on the wisdom of practice, drawing on the wisdom of making reasonable conclusions from a number of other sources and data to try to think about how do we respond right now in the world that we have to live in the practicing and teaching situation that we find ourselves.
I mean, it sounds like it's pretty tough to be an educator these days. And one thing that I'm wondering, though, is while we hear of, you know, educators who want to know the best practice, the best way to discuss different topics, every so often there will be a headline of a horror story of some teacher doing something egregious. What's going on? I guess, I mean, we don't know what's going on in their mind, but I mean, how is this still happening?
Yeah. And again, that goes back to one of the key considerations that I thought about in terms of all that was kind of coming, you know, out in 2020 and even before 2020, is that there were these repeated cases. And, you know, I'm sure many of the listeners can think of examples that they saw either in their news feed or, you know, on television of some, you know, outrageous comment or event or lesson plan or whatever that happened in this school or that school somewhere in the United States of America. So I'm no different in that regard in terms of knowing and becoming aware of these kinds of things and just scratching my head, like, how in the world did this happen? Asking exactly what you just said. And so that's why the first step of the protocol is to plan. That is the very first step of the Real Talk Protocol, is to plan. And I lay out ways that we might go through the planning process to, again, first interrogate yourself as the educator, but also interrogate the issue, plan critically and in an informed way, prepare for the kind of conversation that you're going to have in class. This is not an off the cuff kind of a situation. This is not something you should try to do kind of off the top of your head. This is something you need to have a real plan for, think it through, and then preview that plan, which is step two, so that you can refine what you're thinking, refine the evidence base related to it, raise other questions that maybe you didn't think about when you were planning it yourself, but you preview it with others who can help you to kind of refine what you're doing before you launch, which is the last three steps, which is to put it in context, point out the evidence, and then pin up and return. So those last three steps, that's the actual conversation, the actual real talk in terms of launching it. But then after that, you go right back into planning. You listen and you engage through that conversation. You go right back into planning. What did you learn from your students? What did you learn about the topic from the student's perspective that you didn't know when you went into the discussion? So this is exactly the kind of issue in terms of that, you know, kind of a high profile faux pas, right? That's exactly the kind of thing that the Real Talk Protocol is designed to, if not completely eliminate, because, you know, it's not something that the whole United States of America knows about, right? But those who actually do read the book and follow what's in the book, they won't be doing the kinds of things that you're talking about.
Now, I know earlier I said I'm a bit of a pessimist, but hearing these methods gives me hope. And it's something that I wish was around when I was in school, just for teachers to be able to get feedback from their students on topics that might affect them and hear from their actual experiences. And so what is your advice to those who wish to have conversations on these kinds of topics and aren't sure where to start? I know you mentioned like planning ahead, but let's say somebody isn't an educator, but wants to tackle some of these topics.
Yeah, the Real Talk Protocol works outside of education. I wrote this and directed it to the audience of educators with the assumption and with the urging that educators be supported by local school boards, by legislators, by parents, by other community educators, by education journalists, you know, et cetera, university professors. So I absolutely directed this to educators, but there's absolutely no reason why this protocol couldn't work in a non-education setting, whether it's an office space or a nonprofit space or wherever you are in a church or religious or synagogue or mosque, whatever it is, you can use this approach to try to first, again, interrogate yourself and also clearly interrogate whatever the issue is that you want to think through and discuss with others, with the hope and with the aim that we're going to get at a fair-minded, a good, a reliable kind of understanding, and not merely go for political points or any number of other agendas that might govern that kind of a conversation.
Are schools the best place to have these conversations? And I ask this just because, you know, there are parents who argue they want to have control over curriculum. And as an educator and academic, are there any issues that arise when too many people want to have control over the curriculum?
Well, that's always been the case. It's never been that that teachers or and administrators alone decide what's a curriculum, what's important, what's worth teaching and what's not. It's never been true that only teachers and administrators do that. Schools are not sealed off from society. Organizational theory makes it clear that schools have to respond to the environments that they're in. There are political implications of that. There are budget implications. There's all sorts of things that, you know, are the reason why that's the case. But my point is, there's always been multiple people in control of what we call curriculum. And I talk about that point in the book. And a lot of people think that curriculum is just something that comes from school, but that's really not true. And there's a lot of evidence. And this is, again, an example of what I'm saying, based on scholarship, based on a number of other evidence that we already know, that sometimes what's in the curriculum is not necessarily true or even good. It's just what's popular. It's just what people agreed and decided should be there. So there's nothing new about that. What I'm seeing is that there is disagreement or worry or concern over who in that mix is getting their way or getting their say, if you will. That's the view that I'm, you know, having as I look at it. Schools have not historically served all students well in the United States of America. There wouldn't have been a Brown versus Board if that were already true, right? There wouldn't have been civil rights legislation and all the other things that are very clearly and plainly on the record. If schools in the United States have always served all students well, there wouldn't have been legislation around including students with exceptionalities and all this kind of stuff, right? So it's just a very clear evidence-based point that schools have not always served all children well. However, as I said before, there has been change. There has been things that are true now that weren't always true. But that's where we get into whose voices are being heard, who's having their say, and who feels like they're not having their say, and whether or not they feel that's justified and legitimate or not. Those are debates and arguments that we're going to have. What I ask is that we do that with veracity, that we do that with honesty, we do that with fair-mindedness, and be open with reliable sources of evidence, that we put it available for all of us to see, that there's no kind of a hidden special revelation that only we have over here and you all don't have it over there. No, let's open it up. Let's all look at the same information and let's see if we can come to a reasonable understanding based on what we all are trying to do here.
How hard has that become, having conversations with folks and using resources that are accurate with the way things spread so virally online these days?
Well, I mean, in terms of education research, policy making, and this may break some people's hearts, policy making has not historically been based on research. That's just, I mean, you know, there's this research policy nexus that we as scholars and educators specifically want to have, you know, evidence and data inform, you know, all the legislation that comes up. But the reality is it doesn't. And again, that's a reflection of the society in which we live. Those values that are contested and that are competing commitments, if you will, that we have as a society. So yeah, I mean, that's just the truth, is that research and evidence has not always informed policymaking. That's nothing new. And this recent moment of, you know, really, really partisan, as people say, partisan politics, which has always been that. But, you know, what some even in the world of politics are referring to as extreme and, you know, unprecedented and so forth. Of course, that's going to make all that much more difficult. And that's, you know, that's a part of why people are concerned about legislation, not just in this state, but across the United States, that just seems to be completely about whatever political kind of thing. It's not tied to evidence. It's not tied to actual events on the ground in their communities. People are scratching their head and saying, I don't even see why this kind of a, you know, legislation or law would be needed in light of what I'm seeing in my, you know, in my community, in my school, et cetera. So yeah, that's a, you know, that's a continuation of the past, not a departure from the past.
We're speaking with Marcus Kroom. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're spending the hour with Marcus Kroom, Assistant Professor of Literacy, Culture, and Language Education at Indiana University Bloomington, and author of Real Talk, How to Discuss Race, Racism, and Politics in 21st Century American Schools. Before the break, you touched upon sort of the political aspect of this, and there's legislation that's being pushed. I know that Senate Bill 167 here in Indiana was proposing to put limitations on conversations about race, religion, and politics, and it ultimately didn't go through. What were your thoughts when you heard about this?
I don't know much about that bill. I am hearing, continuing, I should say, to hear about House Bill 1134, and even that bill has changed, so I don't at all want to make any hard and definitive statements about either one because they're just moving and changing and morphing. But yeah, I mean, the impression that I, you know, came away with is the extent to which not just H Bill, you know, 1134, but any kinds of bills across the United States. And I actually refer to legislation in Tennessee. So I address this in the book very forthrightly. Indiana's public legislation was not on my radar at that time. It was, you know, maybe in progress, but that's something that was introduced after my book was already published. So it's not mentioned. But I do say that, you know, it was already clear that a number of states might do similar legislation as to what's in Tennessee and other places. And so, without making any definitive points about the bill one way or the other in terms of its language and, you know, all that, my question is, you know, does that bill or any of these other bills meet the level of rigor that I recommend for educators in the Real Talk protocol? And so, as I said before, those five steps for the Real Talk protocol are to plan, to preview, to put it in context, to point out the evidence, and to pin up and return. And so if I just kind of take that model of what's in the book and think about all of this legislation that's popping up now, you know, one question we could ask is, well, how well planned is, you know, in this case, House Bill 1134, especially in light of conflicting bills like House Bill 1182, which would require that school board candidates state a political affiliation on the ballot. That's what House Bill 1182 proposes. And so if the aim of House Bill 1134 is to reduce the level of politics in schools and classrooms, why advocate for political affiliations in school board elections with bills such as House Bill 1182? So, you know, again, the question of planning there, as I recommend that educators do, you need to be well planned with how you approach the Real Talk protocol. So I would just, again, reflect through that lens on what's happening legislatively. And also, with whom did the legislators preview HB 1134? what was suggested by those who previewed that legislation, and what did they say should, you know, how should that bill be refined to the benefit of Indiana residents, especially those Hoosiers who are not well served by Indiana schools. And we have a number of examples, again, going back to evidence and what we can pull very clearly from the public record. There are a number of Hoosiers who are not yet well served in Indiana schools. So did they preview what's in that bill or any other bill that affects their child's education and their community? And then thirdly, how is House Bill 1134 connected to the context of American schooling, education research, and public issues? For example, public issues like school funding allocations, that's a public issue. Known racial disparities, that's a public issue. Prevalent misinformation about education, that's a very clear public issue. And there are some Hoosiers that'll talk about having the experience of repeatedly unfair decision-making that harms them or ignores them. Those are all very, you know, clear public issues in this state and across the United States of America. And then in terms of pointing out the evidence, well, point out the evidence that informs House Bill 1134. Is this evidence reliable? Is it publicly available for anyone to access? These are the kind of questions that educators are urged and suggested that they ask and work through as they carry out the Real Talk protocol. And again, if we just turn in the direction of these bills, we could ask a similar question. And finally, is there a pin up and return kind of approach to the legislation? In other words, does House Bill 1134 explicitly state an open-ended view of all that is addressed in the bill? Is the bill designed to be revisited and revised regularly in light of new information or new conditions? Again, following the Real Talk protocol, teachers are expected to pin up and return and come back to these conversations with the assumption that we have not solved it by one conversation. We have not solved it even by a series of conversations. These are huge, major public ongoing issues that require us to revisit it and to update in light of new information, new conditions. Is the legislation process and this bill in particular informed by that kind of an approach? And so, you know, again, it's not about attacking this or that part of the bill in terms of language, but just, you know, broadly using the model that I suggest to teachers and asking of, you know, this legislation, all other legislation related to education, have we done those five steps?
Would it be fair to say that education has become politicized because it's an easy target to go after?
No, it's not politicized because it's easy. It's politicized because it's connected to society and to human needs and human interests, et cetera. There's no way that education can be non-political, if you will. The schooling that we have in the United States is based on states, taxpayers, right? Elections in school board or others. So there's no way to disentangle schooling from politics. A part of how schooling came to be is because of politics and the values and the interests of those political fights are very clear. If you go back and look at the record, you can see what the value was, right? Who is valued, who's not valued, who's a priority, who is not a priority, right? In terms of budgets, in terms of actual policies and practices, in terms of all sorts of things, you know, discipline data, I mean, all of it. There's all sorts of evidence that makes it very clear in terms of looking at it from a practice perspective, what priorities are. And so it's not because it's an easy target. It's because it's a part and a reflection of who we are, not just as individuals, but also as a collective, who we regard as worth respect, worth dignity, worth the goods that we all want. That's a part of why education is a political issue.
So it seems like also if we look at it from that perspective, as you've mentioned, what we see in schools is going to be reflected out in society, depending on how our education goes.
Absolutely right. And that's exactly what I'm getting at with the The illustration that I include in the book, I'm going to flip to the book quickly to jog my memory. On page five in the book, I have a diagram of the reality imperative, and that includes human beings living in society and learning in schools. And all three of those elements are intertwined and cannot be disentangled. And schools have a need to respond to society, and in like manner, society is responsive in some ways to schools, for good or ill. Sometimes it's a good kind of response, and sometimes not so much. So this is ongoing. This is one of the points I really try to hit home and really bring to people's awareness through the book, that these issues, these public issues like race, racism, and politics, these public issues are ongoing. Most of them, if not all of them, existed before you were born. So what's the likelihood that there's going to be a quote unquote quick fix, or a quote unquote easy fix, or a one-time conversation and we're done? Now, that doesn't mean we can't make progress. It doesn't mean we can't take definitive action for good and to stop harms. That doesn't mean that at all. But this idea of kind of a one and done is not realistic. It's unreal to refer to it as I do in the book. That's an unreal way to think about it. And it does more harm than good.
It makes me wonder if some folks are thinking, well, we are going to discuss these topics. We're going to make a checklist and say, we discussed this, this, and this, we're good to go. But really, it's something that needs to be continuously, as you mentioned, reviewed and looked upon and adjusted and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's the reason why it's a protocol and it's not a checklist. I'm not saying that you go through the checklist and then have a party. It is a protocol. It is a way of understanding how we do business, if you will. These are the practices and processes that we have agreed to engage in, make adjustments if need be, change, you know, discard, you know, if it turns out not to be helpful, absolutely discard it. Right. As a researcher, that doesn't hurt my feelings. We as researchers have to adapt and change all the time. That's not unusual for the work that I do. But it very much is something that we have to commit ourselves to, and not for any small or selfish, even kind of a narrow understanding of what's at stake and what it's about, but one that's really broader, one that's connected to something bigger than, you know, a political cycle or a particular funder or whatever, any number of other things that could be the key interest or the aim. We've got to rethink ourselves as human beings and rethink the human beings around us in some fundamental ways that allows us to really do the sort of things that we've all said that we value, that we all say we think is important.
Indiana isn't necessarily alone in the debate. As you mentioned, you were looking at some other states with regards to what's being discussed in classrooms, but our state seems to be in the spotlight a lot more. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know quite what to make of that yet. I'm new as a resident to the state of Indiana, so I have a lot to learn about my new home state. So I don't know quite what to make of that. I'm aware of, some really important history with how schools were rearranged, and specifically in the Indianapolis area, Marion County area. So I'm aware of that history. I'm aware of the history of segregation in schooling in this state. You know, those kind of a broad historical points, you know, those are things that I've been made aware of and read about. But, you know, in terms of details as to why Indiana is kind of, you know, in people's minds, either locally or nationally, I really can't say. I don't know. I mean, we certainly obviously had before this current federal administration, of course, the vice president was from this state. So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But the point is, I think that's true based on what I'm seeing. But I really don't. I'm not sure why at this point.
What can folks do to support efforts to have real conversations and really listen and take in the information and do something with it? You know, maybe they're going to go through the real talk protocol, but how can they actually make sure that they've taken action and there's something coming out of it?
Yeah, I think that people can choose to value actual information over whatever assumption may be in mind or circulating at the time. And what I mean by that is, once we actually say, you know, we're going to ask the question, we're not going to assume the answer before we even ask, right? We're going to have the conversation, and we're going to have the conversation not to make my point, but to try to really understand where you're coming from and see if I can, you know, get a sense of how you came to the point of view and the worldview that you're clearly holding, right? That is a choice that we can or can't make. It's up to us. So if we make the choice to really try to move away from just assumptions to actual information, I think that move in itself will not only help overall, but I think it has the possibility to convince people, you know, personally in ways that they may not be convinced by other means, right? So if someone individually decides to kind of suspend their assumption and try to really listen and go after actual information, they may shock themselves with what they find and what they discover from suspending the assumption and trying to really get at real information. They may not be. They may find out exactly what they thought the case was from the very beginning. So, you know, I'm not at all being naive, but the point is, that's a choice for us to make. If we really want to know something, we have literally taken people to the moon. We just recently had in the private sector, people traveling to space. I mean, we can figure out anything we really want to figure out. I don't think it's a matter of capacity. I don't think it's a matter of not having anywhere to go to begin to try to understand or make sense of these kinds of things. I think we just have to make the decision that that's what we want to do. And that also is tied to honesty as well. I'll mention that, because if we're not honest about what our aims are, we will put out a proxy for what's really, you know, the agenda for us. And so I think that's another thing I should add, is that the more we're honest about what we really want, what our real aim is, and putting it out there, as opposed to putting up proxies to stand in, so to speak, or to represent in some way, or maybe even hide what we really want to do, I think that's another way to make progress as well. Because if we keep putting up proxies for other things that are really not what we're after, we're not going to get anywhere, because we're not dealing honestly with each other. And even when someone might attempt to collaborate or compromise or whatever it is that they need to do, it won't lead to a resolution, because that's not really what you want anyway.
If our listeners want to learn more about your book or any workshops or things that you conduct, where can they go?
Right now, in terms of the public, I mean, I've got some research things and publications and stuff, you know, in progress on the more scholarly side. But the book is really it. And again, it is directed specifically to educators, no question, but absolutely parents, because I'm hoping that parents will indeed support educators as they endeavor to do real talks, legislators, because I certainly hope that they will support educators as they endeavor to do these real talks, journalists, et cetera. All of these different audiences, all of these different stakeholders in our schooling as Americans, as Hoosiers in the state of Indiana, all of these different stakeholders can draw something from this book. And again, I hope the most important thing that you draw from the book is that we need to be supportive of educators who are not responding to a problem that they themselves have created. This is not an issue that they're creating and somehow, you know, ginning up in schools and classrooms. They're responding to something that's already there. They're responding to a condition and to issues not of their own making individually, but is a reflection of our broader society, of history, of policy making and policy decisions that some of them don't even know the origins of. All of this is a real, more honest way of beginning to account for why we're having to have these real talks in the first place.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, Marcus Kroom, Assistant Professor of Literacy, Culture, and Language Education at Indiana University, Bloomington. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.